First reading is John chapter 14, verse 6. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through me. Then in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 3 through 8. For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and he was buried, and then he arose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas, then by the 12. After that, he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that, he was seen by James, then by all the apostles. Then last of all, he was seen by me also, as by one born out of due time.
Thank you, Jimmy. It's good to see everyone here this morning. Looking forward to the spring season. Got a taste of it yesterday and then again today. We are pleased to see some visitors with us today. We're always delighted to have visitors come in and be with us. Your presence today makes up for some of our own number who are out. But hope you benefit from the time that we spend together today in our worship to God and our study of His Word. We have been engaged over the last several weeks in a series of studies that I call Answering Critics. We live in a very skeptical age, and there are a lot of people today in our culture who attack everything that Christians are or claim to be or claim to honor. And we need from time to time to come back and revisit some of the basics of our faith, and in particular, learn how to defend what we believe. Previous lessons, we've talked about the importance of objective truth as the means by which we can know anything, including the answers to some of the questions and controversies we're talking about here. We spent a lesson talking about God. Does God exist? And how can we know? How can we be reasonably certain that there is a God who controls all? And in that context, we talked also about evil and suffering. If, in fact, there is a good and all-powerful God, why would he allow all the evil and suffering that we see in the world around us today, some of which touches our own lives? How can we believe in God at the same time that we're suffering? Last week, we spent a lesson talking about the Bible. We believe the Bible to be the inspired Word of God, but how can we be confident of that description? How can we know that the Bible is not just a random collection of old fables and myths and whatnot that has been accumulating over the years? So we spent a lesson talking about that. And that brings us then to the subject of our study this morning, and that is Jesus of Nazareth. Now here is a man who never went to an institution of higher learning. He never wrote a book. He never led an army or held a political office. He never made some great technological invention that has served mankind well. In fact, he left no physical descendants in order to establish some great dynasty, as men often do. When you look at just the bare facts of this man's life, there was nothing remarkable about him, who he was, where he came from, what he did, none of that really makes much sense to warrant the kind of attention that he has received throughout the years. And yet, his impact on human history is incalculable. Even those who do not claim to be Christians or followers of Christ generally recognize his Sermon on the Mount as the greatest commentary on ethical behavior that's ever been promulgated. You read the Sermon on the Mount and you come away just flabbergasted. Yes, this is what humanity ought to be. And it's Jesus that we have to thank for that. And you just Look at your calendar. Have you ever considered the fact that the way that we date history is almost universally by the birth of Christ? All mankind recognizes in one way or another, whether or not they believe in the claims of Jesus, they recognize there's something about this man that sets him apart from all the rest of the human race. And yet, even today, there are those who see fit to criticize him, that he is not the great man that so many people believe him to be. He certainly is not the Son of God. And so here we are who wear the name of Christ, and we have to be able to answer those kind of critiques. How can we defend Jesus of Nazareth as being worthy of adoration and honor and respect and even worship that we give him in the face of the criticisms that come from the world around us? And that's going to be the subject of our study this morning. Now again, here, as with all the other lessons, this is such a vast topic. There's so many different directions that we could go that we are, of necessity, going to have to limit ourselves to just a few basic elements here to try to touch the high points of our topic. But what I'd like to do today is to look at three basic questions. Number one, did Jesus really exist? Number two, who did Jesus claim to be? And number three, did Jesus really rise from the dead? I think in addressing those three questions, we're going to cover the bulk of a lot of the criticisms that people have about Jesus, or at least how people today tend to view Jesus. So let's turn our attention to the first question, did Jesus really exist? Now the argument here on the part of a fairly significant number of people in our society today is that there actually was no historical person named Jesus. That the one that we think of as Jesus was actually a creation of some fanatical Jews in the first and second centuries who were upset with all the things going on in their culture, and they sort of created this idea of Jesus that has all the elements that we think of as Jesus that are recorded in our New Testament. And the argument goes, these Jews who created this figure out of whole cloth were drawing on sources that were very common in cultures around them in that day and time of dying and rising gods. In Egypt, there was Osiris and Horus and all the legends regarding these gods dying and then coming back to life again. And so what the Jews did, or what this little group of Jews did, is in their frustration with all the problems and the headaches that their people and humanity in general was dealing with, they created this idea of a man who said and did all these wonderful things, and he died, and then he came back from the dead, and over a period of time, all of that legend got congealed into the gospel stories that have been recorded for us in the New Testament. Now, to you and I, we hear that and we think, you've got to be kidding. But no, there are a lot of people in our society today who are dead serious about this. They're convinced that there never was an historical figure named Jesus. Certainly not the one that we read about in the New Testament. You may have heard, it's been about 10, 15 years ago, there was a movie that came out. And it still exists on the internet. You can look it up, called Zeitgeist. And it is really a convoluted mishmash of conspiracy theories about the United States government and 9/11 and the Apollo moon landings and so forth. And part of that movie dealt with the question of the origins of Christianity. And it argued that there was no such man as Jesus, and he's just a creation of all these ancient myths that somebody threw together, and Jesus is the Jewish version of those myths. About the same time, Bill Maher, the renowned comedian or commentator, whatever you want to call him, he came out with a movie called Religulous, in which he ridiculed the whole idea of religion. He's a devout atheist, And he just attacks anything that has to do with religion. And in that movie, he appealed to the idea that there really was no Jesus. He was just a creation of some fanatical Jews in the first century, and we should not even pretend that the man even existed. So that's why we're having to spend some time addressing this particular complaint or criticism. And of course, there are all kinds of websites and blogs. You can go on the internet and find anything, including people who will argue that Jesus never existed. So what is the evidence that there was, in fact, a historical figure called Jesus of Nazareth? Now, of course, our immediate response is going to be the New Testament. And of course, at that point, people will roll their eyes, well, of course, that's where all of these legends have been documented. Do you really believe that? Well, give me a good reason why not. You think of any other historical figure from 2,000 years ago or beyond, what is the historical documentation for the existence of any of these characters of ancient history? Julius Caesar, Alexander the Great, Nebuchadnezzar. Go on and on. Herodotus, all of these men. Where do we get the idea that any of these men really truly existed? The actual documentary evidence for the existence of any of these great figures of ancient history is vanishingly small. It's not nearly as great as the documentary evidence that exists in the New Testament, dating right back to the very edge of the first century, documents describing the existence of Jesus of Nazareth. And yes, that's what constitutes our New Testament today, but I just pose the question, why ridicule that? Why treat that documentary evidence as though it's not worth anything, it doesn't mean anything, and we should just disregard it? It is by far the greatest volume of documentation for any historical figure that we have from ancient times. Any concerns about this man that is known as Jesus of Nazareth? So let's not be so quick to dismiss what the New Testament documents say about the existence of Jesus. You may not like what these documents teach or the claims that this man who is called Jesus made for himself. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let's not make ourselves look foolish by denying the man ever existed. But the New Testament is not the only source of information we have regarding the existence of this man, Jesus. There are a number of secular sources from the first and second centuries that likewise mention Jesus. Now, not nearly to the extent that the New Testament does, but they at least acknowledge the fact that there was this man that was called Jesus or Christ, and that there were some certain things that came from this man's life. Tacitus and Suetonius were Roman historians. They wrote a great deal, at great length, about the history of the early Roman Empire. And they, in a couple of places, mentioned just in passing concerning this man Christ that had something to do with the Jews, and there was a lot of trouble and uproar about him. They don't go into any great detail because it doesn't really pertain to the primary purpose of their histories, which is the Roman Empire, but they mention the man. And that's important to note. Josephus was an important Jewish historian of the late first century. He played a key role in the Jewish wars in which the city of Jerusalem and the temple was utterly destroyed. And he wrote at length regarding the antiquities of the Jews and the wars of the Jews. And in two or three places in his writings, he mentions Jesus. Now, there are some who would complain or offer the counterpoint that, well, what you read in Josephus is really just later interpolations that Christian scribes kind of snuck into the documentation. That doesn't hold. We won't go into all the details and reasons here, but if you're interested in that, do some research on that, and you'll find that while one or two of those references, you might could make that argument, the bulk of what Josephus says about Jesus is valid. It's part of what he wrote. The record is there. So to argue that Jesus never existed is to really take a trip into fantasy land. There is a professor of religion at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. by the name of Bart Ehrman. Maybe you've heard of him. He's done a bit of work on both videos. You see him online a lot. The great courses. He has several of the great courses on religion. He is responsible for. He's written a number of books at a popular level. He's an atheist. I guess to be fair, he's an agnostic who leans toward atheism. He actually started out as a believer, fundamentalist believer, but through the course of time, he finally came to give up his faith in God and Christianity. And although he still teaches religion as an academic subject, he himself personally doesn't believe in it. I just mentioned that little bit of biography to let you know that what I'm about to show you is not the rantings of some Christian who's trying to attack his enemies. This guy doesn't believe in Christianity anymore. And yet, it surprised him to find out that there are those who believe that Jesus never really existed. A few years ago, Bart Ehrman wrote a book called Did Jesus Exist? The Historical Argument for Jesus of Nazareth. And here is really the summary of what he was saying in this book. For anyone to whom both evidence and the past matter, a dispassionate consideration of the case makes it quite plain. Jesus did exist. He may not have been the Jesus that your mother believes in, or the Jesus of the stained glass window, or the Jesus of your least favorite televangelist, or the Jesus proclaimed by the Vatican, the Southern Baptist Convention, the local megachurch, or the California Gnostic. But he did exist, and we can say a few things with relative certainty about him. Now again, this is a man who does not believe in the teachings of Jesus. He makes no claims to follow him, but his professional integrity forces him to argue he did exist. So we can dispatch, I think fairly easily, the complaint that there really was not a historical character named Jesus. That brings us then to the second question, and that is, who did this Jesus claim to be? When you look at what the New Testament records about Jesus and his teaching, there are a number of remarkable claims that Jesus made for himself. He claimed, for example, in John 8:58, that he was the I Am, before Abraham was, I Am. In other words, that he always existed. He claimed in John 14:6 that he was the only means of access to the Father. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. I'm the only way you're going to get to God. Jesus scandalized his contemporaries by claiming to have the power to forgive sins, and they knew that only God had that power. Jesus was, in some sense of the word, claiming to be God. When the Sanhedrin council put him on trial for his life, right at the very end, they adjured him, "You tell us, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" And he said, "It is as you say." He claimed to be the Messiah of the Jewish people. And then in John chapter 12 and verse 48, he said, "The words that I speak to you will judge you in the last day." He claimed to be the judge over all the world. These are just some outrageous claims for any human being to make, and yet Jesus made them. These and many others that we could look at. And that, of course, is what turns off so many people today. I mentioned Bart Ehrman a moment ago, the agnostic who affirms that Jesus did exist. He draws a line with these kind of claims. He says these are just claims that later generations put in his mouth, but that Jesus himself never made those kind of claims. Ehrman and others will argue that Jesus was merely an itinerant Jewish preacher who was trying to speak out against the corruption in high places in his day. He did not see himself as the Messiah. According to these people, he did not work any miracles, as has been attributed to him in these gospel records. And the story of Jesus that we read about in the New Testament is simply the result of centuries of embellishment. Over the years, all these legends and myths have accumulated about this Jesus. It's sort of like, I think a good parallel would be King Arthur. You know, historians struggle to pin down whether or not there really was a character known as King Arthur, and if he did exist, what did he do? Well, over the years, there's all kinds of legends that have grown up around this man and all the great things that he did. Is that what we're looking at in the case of Jesus of Nazareth? Can we really say that the gospel records are the result of centuries of accumulated legends and myths that have been made up about this man, and that the real Jesus himself, who Urban argues did exist, though, he wasn't anything like what we read about in the Gospels? So, what about the claims that Jesus made for himself? Can we trust the gospel records and what they say about Jesus and the claims that he is quoted as having made of himself? Now, here too, there's so many different directions that we could go, so much evidence that we would have to consider. Large, vast volumes have been written on this subject, and I can't give it all justice here in the few minutes that we have. But I do want to point to one book that has been written, one individual, I think, whose testimony carries a lot of weight in this question. There is a man by the name of J. Warner Wallace, who's a former homicide detective in California, and his specialty was homicide cold cases. These are crimes that were committed years ago, and the only evidence that's available generally is the testimony of eyewitnesses, some of which have already died, but we have the testimony of these eyewitnesses, but very little actual artifacts with regard to trying to solve these cold cases. And of course, there's a whole science of forensic evaluation involved with how to study and evaluate and draw conclusions based on the evidence surrounding these cold cases. And J. Warner Wallace, in his career as a homicide detective, became quite good at that. In fact, his specialty was combing through the testimony of eyewitnesses and the testimony of these witnesses from many years before and sifting out clues to determine what of that testimony is true and what of it is likely not true. And he developed a very good ability to sift out the false from the true and figure out what exactly happened. And he was able to resolve quite a few of these cold cases using this expertise. During those years, Wallace was also an atheist, quite a strong atheist. You can imagine, here's a man who spends the bulk of his life, his career, dealing with the dark underbelly of humanity. The murder, the crime, the gruesome things that humans are capable of doing to each other. He saw it all. And he just had a hard time dealing with the question of God, being exposed to that kind of stuff all day long. But one of his colleagues confronted him one time, "Why don't you take the techniques that you learn as a forensic scientist, as a detective, evaluating eyewitness testimony, and apply it to the four Gospels?" Just a challenge that this friend offered him, and so Wallace took him on. And he started reading the four Gospels, and he was trying to sort through all this information and the testimony that's recorded in these four books to determine, how can any of this be true? But he said the more that he read these Gospels, the more it began to look familiar to him. These were not legends. These were not myths. That has a whole different character of its own. This read more like the testimony of eyewitnesses that he'd spent his career studying. And he finally came to the conclusion that there's something else going on here. There were four criteria that he applied to the Gospels. They're the same criteria that he would apply as he would study the eyewitness testimony of crime scenes that he was investigating. Number one, were these eyewitnesses present? Did they actually see something? Are they true eyewitnesses? Number two, were they corroborated? Is there any kind of additional background information or evidence that would back up the testimony that they are offering? Number three, were they accurate? Is there any way to ascertain the accuracy of what these people were claiming to have witnessed. And number four, were these eyewitnesses biased? Did they have some kind of skin in the game? Was there some kind of angle here they were trying to play to their own personal advantage? Now, I won't go into all the details of how he sorts all of this out, but he later wrote a book describing where this investigation took him. He eventually became a believer. And it was his study of the four Gospels that convinced him this is not myth. He was reading the testimony of eyewitnesses who lived through and personally saw and experienced the things that they were writing about. Here's how he summed it up in the book that he wrote, Cold Case Christianity. And I quote, "I knew I could never take a blind leap of faith. For me, the decision needed to be a reasonable decision based on the evidence. I asked jurors to do this every time I present a case, to assemble the circumstantial evidence and draw the most reasonable inference from what they have examined. That's what I did as I assembled the cumulative case for the reliability of the Gospels. Philosophical naturalism prevented me from taking miracles seriously, but the apostles claimed to see miracles, and in every way that we typically evaluate eyewitnesses, the gospel authors passed the test." Now again, there's so much more information here that we could go into, but suffice it to say, this homicide detective saw in the records of the authors of the gospel the nature of eyewitness testimony. We can put our confidence in what we're reading here as being the truth. And it was that kind of truth that eventually convinced him to become a follower of Jesus himself. And that brings us then to the third question that we want to consider, and that is, did Jesus rise from the dead? You've probably heard some of the arguments that people offer to contradict what the Bible says about the resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection is central to everything. Christianity is based upon that story. And naturally, that makes it a big target. And so if we can discredit the resurrection, if we can in some way prove it never really happened, it's just a figment of the disciples' imagination, then Christianity and everything else about Jesus pretty well collapses. And so this becomes a major target for those who try to discredit Jesus and his religion. The arguments are just across a spectrum of complaints. Some say that Jesus, yes, was crucified. He was buried in a tomb, but the disciples stole the body and dispensed with it and then went around telling everybody that he had been raised from the dead. Others argue that he never really died. He was on the cross and he was nailed and suffered all these gruesome injuries and he was put in a tomb, but he was just in a coma. And later in that tomb, he revived and he managed to roll that stone away or with some help and he got away. He died off in some far country and we know nothing about that. Others will argue that Jesus on the resurrection morning actually ended up at the wrong tomb. They went to a tomb in which there had never been a body, and nobody was there, and which raises the question, well, the authorities knew where they buried him. They knew where he was. Why couldn't they produce the body? Or some will argue that the apostles just suffered some kind of mass hallucination, that they just thought they saw the resurrected Jesus, even though he never was truly raised. There are others who will argue, and if you ever talk to a Muslim, that this is their standard approach. They say that Jesus was never crucified. Oh, there may have been somebody crucified. Pilate probably nailed somebody to a cross here, but that wasn't Jesus. He was switched with somebody else. That's some other guy that hung on the cross. And so the true Jesus, the true prophet of God, God would never allow his prophet to go through something like that. And so the true Jesus was never crucified. And there's just a number of other explanations that people offer. But the whole idea is to attack the idea of the resurrection, a coming back from the dead. That this Jesus of Nazareth, who did all of these things, taught all of these great truths to people, and was crucified, never came back from the dead. This denial, of course, is not new. We read about this in the New Testament. The Gospel of Matthew says that shortly after the body disappeared, that the Jewish rulers were circulating the rumor that the disciples had stolen the body, and that's why the body could not be produced. Later, in Paul's career, in Acts chapter 26, as Paul is giving his personal testimony before King Agrippa and Festus, the Roman governor, Paul gets to the point where he's talking about the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and that being the central part of his message. And at that point, the governor, Felix, interrupts and says, "Paul, you're beside yourself. Much learning is driving you mad. Paul, you're nuts. People do not come back from the dead. If you're going to try to convince me that this guy Jesus came back from the dead, and that's the basis of your religion, I'm sorry, Paul, I can't buy that." Sound familiar? Well, that's what we're hearing today. I mean, 2,000 years, nothing has changed. People struggle with the idea of this man, or any man for that matter, coming back from the dead. It just couldn't have happened. But, please understand that Jesus himself knew that this was going to be a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow. But this is what he said on one occasion. This is Luke chapter 11, verses 29 through 30. He said, "This is an evil generation. It seeks a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah the prophet. For as Jonah became a sign to the Ninevites, so also the Son of Man will be to this generation." In a nutshell, what Jesus is saying here is, you don't believe my miracles. Okay, fine. Set them aside. You don't believe any of these miracles that I perform, that I actually perform them, okay, fine. You just disregard all of that. He's saying, there's one miracle that I'm going to give you, and you're going to be able to deny this one. I'm going to come back from the dead. Dismiss everything else if you want. This is one you can't walk away from. This is the one sign, he calls it the sign of Jonah, that will be the sign to this generation and to every succeeding generation that I am who I claim to be. That everything I said about myself and about you is true because I will come back from the dead. Now, how can we know that? If Jesus pins his entire program on his resurrection from the dead, then this pretty well is the battleground. This is where it's going to be won or lost. Disprove the resurrection and the whole enterprise crumbles to the ground. It can't be true. And Jesus is not worthy of an ounce of our respect. But prove it. Demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that Jesus did in fact rise from the dead. And boy, that's going to have an impact on our lives, is it not? That's going to force us to have to make some serious considerations about where we're at and where we're going in our lives. There are two lines of reasoning, again, so many that we could look at. Just two we're going to limit ourselves to now. The first one is based on that passage in 1 Corinthians 15 that Jimmy read a moment ago. Now, we've heard this so many times, but have you ever stopped to consider the significance of what Paul is writing here? "For I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was arose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen by Cephas, then by the 12. After that he was seen by over 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain to the present, but some have fallen asleep. After that he was seen by James, then by all the apostles, then last of all he was seen by me also, as by one born out of due time." Now we read that and say, okay, Paul believes Jesus was resurrected. Big deal. That doesn't prove anything. Stop and think. Paul is writing here to the church at Corinth. Now, by universal acclamation, even the most liberal scholars will admit to the fact that the book of 1 Corinthians is, without doubt, one of Paul's original letters. Very few people will argue that somebody else wrote 1 Corinthians and that he wrote it somewhere around the year 54-55 A.D. Now, you'll notice also, though, that Paul is saying here in this letter that he's writing around 54-55, "I delivered to you," past tense. He's referring to the message that he had delivered to the Corinthians several years before when he first came to Corinth. We're pushing now about 20 years after Jesus was crucified and supposedly arose from the dead. Do legends come to full flower in 20 years? That's just not the way legends and myths work. It takes centuries. We're talking about King Arthur a while ago. How many centuries have we had to have this whole body of mythology grow up around King Arthur? Paul is describing something with great certitude barely 20 years after the event happened. I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received. Scholars have come to recognize that opening line is technical language describing a body of knowledge that has been formally passed off from one party to another. The teacher imparts or hands off, delivers to the student some body of knowledge. Paul says, I delivered to you that which I received. Somebody else gave this to Paul, and now he's giving it to the Corinthians. And now he's talking about, he's recording this as an historical fact. Richard Bauckham is a professor of religion at Cambridge University. He has written a number of books on the subject of Jesus and early Christianity, and a few years ago he wrote a book, actually at a technical level. This is a scholarly book, heavily footnoted, not easy to read at all, but it's on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus, particularly, and the gospel records concerning what happened. The name of the book is Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And again, his point, like Wallace discovered in his own investigation, he's trying to peel back the layers of the onion, as it were, and find out what's the core message here in the gospel record, and particularly with relates to the resurrection. And here is a comment that he has regarding this passage in 1 Corinthians 15. He says, and I quote, "The explicitness of this detail shows that he, Paul, intends it to be a kind of authentication. If anyone wishes to check this tradition, a very large number of the eyewitnesses are still alive and can be seen and heard. Paul thus takes for granted the continuing accessibility and role of the eyewitnesses, even extending to a very large number of minor eyewitnesses, as well as to such prominent persons as the 12 and James." In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about, he's addressing the fact that some, even there in Corinth, were starting to deny the resurrection. And Paul starts out by saying, wait a minute, folks. This is what our whole religion is built on. You can't claim to be a Christian and deny the resurrection. Here's what I delivered to you. It's all about the resurrection. And what Professor Bauckham is arguing here is, when you look at the detail that Paul gives, he is enumerating, if you don't believe me, go talk to these people. Some of them are dead, but most of them are still around. You can verify the truth of what I delivered to you by go talk to these people. They're eyewitnesses of the resurrected Christ following his crucifixion. They can verify to you that it happened. More and more scholars are looking at this little tidbit in the back end of 1 Corinthians as one of the most powerful arguments for the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. But there's a second angle that we want to consider here, and we'll wrap it up. And that is that the witnesses of the resurrection of Christ, the very people that Paul enumerates here, these were the most unlikely heroes in the story. Let's put it another way. As eyewitnesses, they were lousy. You know, if they really were trying to create a new religion, is this a way to do it? As far as we can determine, for every one of these people, testifying that Jesus came back from the dead eventually cost them their lives. It certainly cost them a comfortable life here and now. They were ridiculed, they were scorned, they were mocked. They were chased out of town everywhere they went. They were laughed at in their face. Is this success? But they would not give it up. We cannot but tell what we have seen and heard, Peter said. It happened. They saw it. And we have to give our lives for that testimony. We will not give it up. Several years ago, there was a Jewish rabbi by the name of Pinchas Lapid who, like so many others, read the Gospels. He studied them, trying to understand what was the real truth here in the story that was going on. And even though he never converted to Christianity, to the day he died, he remained a Jewish rabbi, he came to the conclusion that Jesus of Nazareth did exist. He was everything he claimed to be, and he came back from the dead. And he wrote a book called The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective. And here is what this Jewish rabbi said. If the defeated and depressed group of disciples overnight could change into a victorious movement of faith based only on autosuggestion or self-deception without a fundamental faith experience, then this would be a much greater miracle than the resurrection itself. Do you understand what the rabbi is saying here? If you're going to claim that the resurrection never really happened and that this crowd of losers invented the new religion of Christianity just by conjuring up these weird things all on their own, he said, that's a bigger miracle than the resurrection itself. It's easier to believe in the resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth is one of the most well-attested events of ancient history, and we would do well to accept it as such. Remember what Pilate said when Jesus was standing by his side? Pilate's addressing the crowd. He doesn't believe that Jesus is guilty of anything, certainly not worthy of death. And the crowd keeps crying out, crucify him, crucify! And Pilate posed this question to the crowd, then, what shall I do with Jesus? Don't you see, folks? That's the same question that every one of us has to face. What shall I do with Jesus? God has gone to extraordinary lengths to give us all the evidence that we should need to know what the truth is. Yes, this man really did exist. Yes, he has claimed authority over your life. And he has proved it by coming back from the dead. Jesus is not going to force you to submit to him. But I can assure you, you have no excuse not to fall down at his feet and give him your life. Won't you do that now? If we can help you become a disciple, a follower of this resurrected Jesus, won't you come now as we stand and sing the invitation song?